That's a good point. We're with Bernie Taylor back in Grimerica. Thanks for joining us, Bernie. This is an exciting one. You always send me these awesome emails. You're like, hey, what about this topic? And now we're talking Malta and Atlantis. So we've been talking about Atlantis and we're going to Malta, but I haven't really seen many people talk about the two together. So welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, guys. This is my sixth episode since 2019. I feel that we are growing old together. Are you feeling that way, Darren?
Yeah, I think that would put you, that would actually put you at like number two, I think, for all-time guests. And I don't know if you can see behind my head here, but if you look down behind my mullet, you'll see the picture that you sent to us, I guess in 2019. That would have been in 2019.
When we had the office. Yeah, we had the office, Darren. I remember getting
that picture
in the office.
So Randall's number one, right, guys? Yeah. Randall's number one?
Yeah, I think we've done 10 or 12 with him. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we need to work
but
on
But I think Bernie's number two.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what made you get into Malta? I mean, we know, you know, you're talking about the Atlas Mountains a lot and the other side of North Africa there, but why Malta now?
Why Malta? Well, it actually kind of follows. We were at Göbekli Tepe this past June. We were in the Eastern Mediterranean. And I got to thinking about Göbekli Tepe being there. And on site, you see all these massive megaliths. You see large art of animals and so forth. But then you go to the nearby Stanley Urfi Museum. And everything's small. I mean, everything's like smaller than this, and maybe some down to this. And there, the Stanley Urfi Museum has artifacts from other sites as well in the region. And they, most of them are pretty small. The artifacts at the Stanley Urfi Museum are completely different, the iconography, the themes, than they are at the Standing Stones of Göbekli Tepe. They're different stories. So from my perspective, the small is telling the story of Göbekli Tepe. And the small is, the small is greater than the large, one could say. And I, from my perspective, I think people got Göbekli Tepe all wrong. And not only did they get Göbekli Tepe wrong, but the same themes we find in Malta that we're gonna cover today. Now, I'm not going to tell you the big versus small Göbekli Tepe and the Stanley Urfi Museum, because we're going to save that from when you do a contact in the cabin for Göbekli Tepe. Fair game, guys?
Fair game.
It's on the board. It's on the board of places we want to go, and we have been hooked up with some great guides over there from a few people. And I think it's actually the same one that we've got a few recommendations on. So we were all geared up to get going there. And then when we talked to the one guide, he was like, you might want to wait 6 months.
No, it's totally safe. People are welcome as hell there. We had, I had breakfast one morning at the hotel. It was kind of a, you know, up on the roof sort of thing, and walked out to get some Kleenex at a pharmacy on the way out to meet our guide. And I had some breakfast on my white shirt, which I didn't realize. And the guy in the pharmacy took a wipe out and wiped off my shirt, the bottom of my shirt. That's how nice people are there. I mean, he could have laughed at me. He could have just thrown the wipe at me, but he actually wiped off my shirt. And that is the people in Stanley Urfi that is nearby to Göbekli Tepe. They're welcome beyond belief that you just can't imagine. So I recommend you guys get on the next plane, pull together a crowd and your gang and make it happen. But we're not here to talk about Göbekli Tepe. We're here to talk about Malta, your next coming up big adventure with Contact at the Cabin. And I look forward to seeing the images of the cabin that you are staying at in Malta. But I'm going to pitch this. I'm going to tell this story through Atlantis. Was Malta Atlantis? And I'm not the first person to tell this story. This is was tied together, Malta Atlantis. It's out there. You know, it's out there. And I'm going to break it into three parts, so chapters of sorts. Atlantis mythology and popular culture. The case for a Maltese Atlantis. Because there's a case there for sure. And is this all written in the stars? Okay.
So the Wasn't Shin kind of pointing at Malta as well when we had him on? I know you had some Egypt stuff as well, but was Matthew Shin also pointing to Malta at all, or did he just skip right over it?
I'm not sure. I think
he's or maybe it was just on the line. Like I believe Malta was on some. So people have to go back and check out the episode we did with Matt Apocalypse. It's in the back catalog there. But I swear that there was something in there about Malta being on this line between the Azores and Egypt that he was pointing out to be important for some reason.
Oh yeah, it's the narrative. It's out there. I didn't make it up. And so what is a myth? What is a myth? Because people say that Plato's Atlantis is a myth. Well, it's a story of ostensibly historical events to explain a practiced belief or a natural phenomenon. We're all good with that, right? In the case of Plato, it's also a moral responsibility, a parable, that sort of stuff. So there's different ways to look at myths. And we're going to look at Malta's Atlantis from different perspectives. Now, we directly receive the Atlantis story from Plato in his Timaeus and Critias, and he left us this lost Atlantis civilization. Okay, now you guys may not know that in the School of Athens, on the School of Athens, in the Vatican Museums in Rome, Leonardo da Vinci is Plato, and under his arm is the Timaeus. Did you guys know that?
No.
No.
Well, the Pope knows about it, so someone's hiding something there. But yeah, you could look at the image, you can see it. It's his Timaeus. So it is under the arm of Plato, who has the representative face of Leonardo da Vinci. Okay. So this is serious stuff. So where is Malta? Well, everybody that is currently booked on your tour knows that it's just south of Sicily. And we can see it represented relative to Athens. It's not so far away. It's close enough that Plato knew where Malta was, okay, and had some history of Malta. So what is the story that is not in Timaeus Critias, the story that's out there? Well, there's no electronics, there's no submarines, there's no stargates and the like. But there is, because I've read this a number of times, there's art. There's geometry for construction. There's astronomy for ocean navigation, not procession. It doesn't say that procession. Law, government, stone architecture, animal husbandry, and worship bulls. So we're going to look at some of these elements that are actually written into Plato's work to see if they can be found at Malta. Okay, but again, no electronics, submarines, stargates, and the like, except on TV. So Plato said Atlantis was destroyed by natural forces. Okay. So now we're going to go to the case for a Maltese Atlanta. And there's different ways of looking at Plato made up the whole story. Is it a myth? Is it an allegory? Are the locations of Malta reasonably close to where Plato says this Atlantis is? Well, Plato said, he wrote, one would say, that it's a great island that lay over against the pillars of Hercules or Heracles. In greater extent than Libya and Asia put together, as was the passage to other islands, okay? So, according to Plato, Atlantis is next to Pillars of Hercules at the Strait of Gibraltar, but there's other islands. So why can't Malta be one of those other islands, right? We have no problem with that, right, guys?
Okay.
It could be one of those other islands. Okay. Now, he also said that the empire of Atlantis reached in Europe to Tyrrhenia, which is all the non-Greek places, and in Libya to Egypt. So it goes from in Libya to Egypt versus deep into Egypt. And so if we drew a line or a circle, we put a circle in that general area, we can see that Malta does fall into this empire or proposed empire of Atlantis from Plato. Are we good with that, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, this might be actually exactly what Matt was kind of showing, except he extended it on the left to include the Azores Islands.
The Azores. Actually, that's interesting.
He had a line from Göbekli Tepe to the Azores, and then the right angle of that, or there was a triangle that was made up to England, too. I can't remember the site in England. I don't know if it's St. Michael's on the coast there. I think it was something else. Maybe not Stonehenge, maybe Avebury. And it was like a perfect triangle or something like that from that. And then there was one that he had from the Giza Plateau as well. But can I interrupt this? Can I interrupt this for a sec?
I think you just did interrupt it.
I have the disaster map up right now. I'm assuming.
No, I do too. No, I do too. I wanted to show it to you. So because I thought that the when I looked at the ice age levels of water, so this is minus 118 meters, right? Basically pre-Younger Dryas flooding. I thought Malta was still an island, but now when I look at it again, it looks like it was attached to all this to Sicily like this. And then that's all like, you know, this is the Mediterranean back then. So this is how close it would have been to Northern Africa. So I don't know if that changes anything about Plato talking about islands, but if it was back to the, that date that everybody thinks Plato was talking about, it was attached or it could have been attached.
So Plato is looking at the area from his time period. He saw islands. He didn't see connected land. Make sense?
Yep. Okay, go back to your presentation. Sorry about that.
He couldn't look back in time. No, it's cool.
And that's from Darren's disastermap.ca. It shows that you can go all around the Mediterranean and see what Greece looks like with all the water. Like a lot of the islands in Greece disappear. They combine into one. Istanbul in Turkey is different. It's quite amazing to look at it with 360 feet less of water.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, it was. But from Plato's perspective, from Athens, from Greece, he sees islands. So the story he's telling is of islands. So he's receiving a story from people before his time, and he's looking over. So I see islands. Okay.
Yeah.
Are my slides up right now?
No, they're not. You got to redo that again.
Okay.
Where you go, Graham?
Yeah.
No, we're all good. I like that idea. It's a matter of time perspective. So Plato's not 12,000 years ago. He's telling it among the ancient Greeks. You tell me, guys.
Okay. It's still not there.
So we have a moment here, and looking at Darren, you look pretty tan. Having some fun in the water?
Yeah. We had a nice hot July finally.
Are you going to do a contact in the cabin where we can all go water skiing with you and fishing and things like that?
Well, I do hunting tours. People can jump on the hunting tours if they want to do that kind of stuff. But ironically, we were just kind of discussing with Brad the possibility of doing a rattle tour up in the Scablands that includes a jet boat ride up the Snake River.
Interesting. I've done that.
Did you? Did the Hell's Canyon or whatever?
Yeah.
How was it?
Wet and wild, you know, had a barbecue, that sort of stuff. But yeah, it was cool. But, you know, I didn't get the Randall tour included, so I didn't have the larger perspective.
That's right. Well, you'll probably have to reshare your thing here. I don't know.
Yeah, you'll have to click on share and redo it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's how it works. Yeah, share. Entire screen. Are we good?
I don't see anything yet.
So,
You might have to stop sharing, Graham. Did you already stop?
Yeah, I stopped, yeah.
Okay, we're going to do this over again.
Okay.
Oh, entire screen. There we go.
There we go.
Let's see it where. Share.
And okay. We're back. There we go. Okay, you just got to get to your slide now. Yeah, there you go.
There it is.
And we got to go to the high because there are things we are hiding in this discussion as we've just have. Okay. Before Plato, there was discussion of Atlantis. Okay. And Herodotus wrote in his histories too, the mountain Atlas was called the Pillar of Heaven by the natives, Atlantes. So it's you could translate Greek into Atlantes or Atlanteans, right? It's the same thing. So lofty, moreover, that the mountain, it is said, cannot be seen, the clouds never quitting it, either summer or winter. Okay? So Plato is not the only one who talked about Atlantis. Okay? And even before Herodotus, Sanchinatho spoke of Atlas as the brother of time, or he wrote of Atlas as the brother of time, who had traveled to the western part of Africa. We were settled on a high mountain that supported the heaven so as to devote himself to the study of astronomy. Okay. And that high mountain for both Sanchinacho and for Herodotus is Mount Atlas. Okay, it's Mount Atlas, which is in the Plato story as well, I believe. And we call it today Jebel Tobelkau. Jebel means mountain. Tobelkau means the major, highest type of thing. And we have Atlas holds up the sky. That is in the Farnese Atlas in outside Naples. And that's a very famous statue. Okay. So it's Jebel Tobelkau. So where is Jebel Tobelkau? Jebel Tobelkau is southwestern Morocco in today's time. Southwestern Morocco, not so far from Marrakesh. People who go to Jebel Tobelkau typically party in Marrakesh first. And it's you can see the Atlas Mountains. They spread. They span all the way up to Algeria. They're not that far from Malta. So from the if you're in the Atlas Mountains and you believe that that's where the Atlanteans are, you're really somewhere in there. You're not that far from Malta. It's all part of the same perspective. So Plato made up the whole story? Absolutely not. People before him, Sanchinatha and Herodotus, talked about the Atlantes. And the locations of the narratives to Malta are reasonably close. Okay. And they all fit into the story. So talking about time, time's important here. And people read this time thing a little differently. My read is 9,000 years is the sum, the island of Atlantis now lies sunk by earthquakes. And my read is that's 9,000 years before Solon. That's my read, who lived 630 BCE. So if we take 9,000 years before Solon, we say 2630 before our present time, Atlantis was 11,630. Now people convert that into BCE, and they have a different number. If someone has a different number, put it in the notes. I want to hear it and how you came up with it. But that's how that's my read of the numbers based on the reading of Plato. I may be wrong. Now, Plato had a thing about numbers. So let's go back. Remember, he talked about 9,000 years before Solon. He didn't say 9,010 years or 9,050 years. And in his Laws too, he talks about their works, Egypt, of art, are painted or molded in the same forms which they had 10,000 years ago. Plato talks in metaphors. So 9,000 years is a big number. It's a long time ago. 10,000 years is even a longer time ago. Did Plato really believe the ancient Egyptians existed 12,400 years before our present time? Of course he did. Okay. Plato throws out these big round numbers to say, this is how long ago it was in the past. And we do that today in music. Okay. Lord, I'm 500 miles from my home. Everybody knows the song, Peter, Paul, and Mary. It's a metaphor for an extended distance of time. Peter, Paul, and Mary were not 500 miles from home. These are metaphors. It's just what it is. So dating as a metaphor, put a question mark there. I say yes. Some people will go to bat to say it was 9,000 years for Solon, but they also then have to own the 10,000 years for the Greeks because they're, this is Plato, how he does things, okay, how he did things. So Malta has pre-Greek archaeological evidence that could have been considered to be part of the Atlantis Empire. And that's really the key to this whole thing. What is the archaeological evidence? So there are at least 66 freestanding megalithic stones in Malta. There's, of course, below as well, which I'm not going to cover today. And the final collapse was 2400 BCE, about or so. Okay. Now, if you go to Wikipedia, there's a narrative that you will hear from your guides when you go to Malta. And you can, nudge them and nudge each other and say, hey, Bernie says it's a little different. And we'll get there. Well, according to Wikipedia, the megalithic stones at Malta were the oldest, they're claimed to be the oldest freestanding structures until Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. That's important. So Malta, as we think of Göbekli today, is like the really big deal, zero age, one in civilization, all that sort of stuff. Well, Malta was before the discovery of Göbekli Tepe. So if we put in the sphere of world history, Malta is right after Göbekli Tepe in our current mindset. So you guys are going to, a major site. It just isn't, beer on Malta at Valletta. You guys are going to a massive site. Now, let's put that into perspective on a timeline. Göbekli Tepe, 10,000, 11,000 years or so, the freestanding Malta temples, 5,000 years ago, which, of course, as you've read and heard many places, that they came before the Great Pyramid of Egypt, and they came before the Sarsen stones at Stonehenge. Okay, so the freestanding temples at Malta are really, really old, and they, in fact, were the oldest ones known before the founding of Göbekli Tepe. Now, archaeologists, and I'm not an archaeologist, no apology, they believe that the Malta megalithic complexes came through a process of cultural evolution. They discovered it on their own. We'll talk about that. I'm not convinced.
Well, I mean, what else are they going to say? Because it's an island, and they're like, well, it's always been an island, and, you know, they didn't have seafaring back then, and, you know, I mean, it's kind of like they're kind of stuck in their own paradigm to say, oh, it must have been them, their own little special culture in Malta that developed all these things.
It's the paradigm. They're stuck in the pre-Göbekli Tepe paradigm, because what they do is they say, so they will now concede that Göbekli Tepe is older than the structures at Malta. So, but then they change and say, now we have the oldest megalithic sites in Europe. Well, Göbekli Tepe is only 2 hours by plane from Istanbul, which is the European cutoff line. Okay. So it's about being the oldest, the most beautiful, the best. We are the most magnificent people. It's politics. It's nationalism. It has nothing to do with archaeology, because they would have just shut up on the war. Now we have the oldest in Europe, because they lost the international for Göbekli Tepe to Göbekli Tepe. But this is the politics. This is not the true archaeology that we are interested in. Okay. So Plato knew of Göbekli Tepe. I'm sorry, he knew of Gigantea temples and other temples on Malta. And he knew they were very old. Okay. And in fact, he did. And he also knew that the Giza pyramids were old. And he also recognized, or the people had been there, the Greeks had been there, would recognize that they appear to be damaged by natural forces. Okay. They look that way. They weren't burnt to the ground, sort of thing. Now, Egypt also has very old ruins, the Great Pyramid of Giza. But Egypt also has a history of who made those ruins, whereas the people of Malta have no history or no living history of who built the temples. That's a big difference. So from Plato's perspective, he would have said, this is a lost civilization in Malta, because we have nobody who knows who was there before. Whereas in Egypt, there's a timeline. You know, it's a timeline writing, it's a timeline images. So it is truly a great mystery. I mean, phenomenal great history. Now, what is known is that the Bronze Age peoples came after the temple builders. Okay, we have a Bronze Age dagger here. But what we also know is that they didn't slaughter the people of Malta. They sort of came and settled in afterwards. So it wasn't a replacement. It wasn't a replacement that overlapped in time. It was the Bronze Age people came after the people of Malta.
Like a recolonization type thing?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I'm not sure if colonization would mean to take over somebody else.
Yeah, basically they were gone. There was nobody there when they got there.
There was nobody there. There's no evidence that the Bronze Age people killed off the people of Malta, because there's no, like, you'd find that in the graves. It just doesn't exist. So putting this into the whole Atlantis timeline, so yes, these people did disappear at Malta. Yes, Plato and friends would have known about that, but it wasn't 11,630 years ago. It wasn't Plato's timeline. It is worth noting, though,
that his timeline lines up eerily with where we know that drastic earth-changing events were taking place. I mean, it's within 5%.
I don't disagree with that. And that is, I don't disagree with that. But in the case of Malta, so I believe that Plato did actually draw from Malta to say it was... everybody who writes a story draws it from someplace else. They may have draw from childhood trauma, right? It might be the love of their life that was then lost or something like that. But we all draw from some place, and I believe that he drew from Malta. So we can say he drew from Malta, he drew from, there were natural unknown forces that was destroyed, because we really don't know. So now we need a better lay of the land, and you guys are going to go to Gigantea. I saw your schedule. You're going to Gigantea temples on Gozo Island. And we can see Gozo Island is just to the north of, we'll call it Malta proper, the mainland of Malta. Okay. And you guys are going to, you're going to take a shuttle, a bus, and then you're going to take a ferry across, something like that. Okay. Gigantea temples. Okay. Now, you guys may not know it, but Calypso's cave from Homer's Odyssey is also on Gozo Island. I did not see that on your schedule, but just let you know it's there. Okay.
I think the guide actually mentioned it.
Oh, he mentioned. Okay, good. Because you need, you know, that's part of the, you know, part of the allure, part of the mystery. And maybe you will be witched for, was it 9 years, 8 or 9 years? Okay. And now, if you have seen Christopher Nolan's Odyssey, you will see that he pictured Calypso's cave off the coast of Morocco at Dune Blanc. Okay. So just put that out there. It's quite a ways from Gozo Island in Malta. But Charlize Theron is absolutely gorgeous, and it's worth, I'll buy the story just because she's in it. Okay. So let's look at some of the artifacts that are at Gigantea Temple. There's bulls. There's artifacts of bulls as described in Plato's Atlantis, and undeniably bulls. And what's interesting, you have the stargazing figure. She's 2.5 inches tall in American speak, 6 centimeters in Canadian speak. And she's looking up at the night sky, the day sky. She's looking up, for that's for sure. She's called the stargazing figure. Now, when you go to these temples, you're going to walk in and you're going to see this huge facade, most except for Gigantea, they're all under canopies. Okay. And you're going to say, well, there's a lot going on here. Well, we're going to start from the outside. We're going to go in. On the outside, there is the perimeter wall, which you will see first. And then inside of the perimeter wall, these apses. Okay. These apses we'll call rooms of sorts. What is an apse? Okay. And I looked this up because I really didn't. I'd heard the term as in being in churches because it's a projecting part of building churches. I knew that. It's usually semicircular or in plan or vaulted. And the most of these temple complexes have the walls kind of go up like this, and it's presumed that they, in fact, were vaulted of some sort. Okay. So between the perimeter wall and the apse, it's filled with stones and earth. That's how it all stays together. Before these were excavated, the soil was up against the perimeter wall itself. So people, before it was excavated, only saw, you know, megalithic stones standing up. Okay. So we have the area filled in. And each one of these has a central corridor. This is important. We're going to get back to this later. Very important, these central corridors. Okay. And this paved courtyards, another important issue we'll get back to later. And each one of these has multiple temples. And A here is said to be the southern temple. B is the northern temple. And they're saying C is an expansion of the northern temple. I don't know. That's what they're saying. That's what the archaeologists said. Okay. There are upright stones that you will walk into with the Gigantea temple. And there's a lintel with the stone that slabs on top. You've seen those at Stonehenge. Okay. Megalithic construction. We're going to look at another. You're going to go to Hagarim, and which is in the southwestern side of Malta. Okay. And there's multiple temples. Okay, there's multiple temples in this. Okay, and within Hagarim, you have these ladies that they're rounded like the stargazing woman, and these are much larger, but these are found throughout the island. At the temples, these women. Okay. So is she a mother goddess? That is one of the narratives that you will hear at Malta, that that these figures are mother goddesses. And without going into Göbekli Tepe, because I said I wouldn't do it, but I believe that Göbekli Tepe is about a mother goddess and not about the guys with penises in the circles. Okay. Tarsian temples, which is near to Valletta. Again, it's covered. And multiple temple rooms. Okay. There's a bull representation at Tarsian temple, Pleos Atlantis. You know, you got to ask, right? And there's other animals, goats, pig, and perhaps a ram. So these are all limed. By the way, all the stones on Malta that I know of are limestone, which is, again, the same as Göbekli Tepe. And most of the buildings, modern buildings, let's say what, hundreds of years ago, were also made of limestone. That was the material. That's what they used, the same way at Göbekli Tepe. Okay. Red paint at the Tarsian temple. There's red paint in a lot of these temples. Plato said they painted in red. You got red paint. I'll go with that. So they worship bulls. They paint temples painted in red. So all these things sort of add up to Plato's Atlantis story, except the whole dating thing. Because Plato threw out big numbers in thousands of years. He really had no way to date. Timing from above. And this is, your guide will have some of this for sure. Absolutely some of this, but your guide won't have all the nuances and expanding material that we're going to do today. And we're going to start with the Menadra temples, which we didn't discuss earlier. And Menadra is right next to the Hadjiim temples in southwestern Malta. There is the lower temple. And at the lower temple, equinox sunrise, you may have seen this image before, the sun rises through. And we can look at that relative to the temple itself and where the sun is from that previous image and how the sun goes to the back of the chamber. And that looks just like this. Now, when are you guys going to be there?
April 26th to May 10th.
Well, you're going to miss this. But, you know, you got to get up early in the morning for this kind of stuff. Okay. Sort of duck hunting morning. Okay. And the Menadra lower temple, you can see the winter solstice rise, and the light goes where that red arrow is to the viewer's right, which is really cool. And at the summer solstice, we can see the sun rise, and it hits that other megalithic stone.
Right on the edge of the megalithic block?
They're both right on the edge.
Wow.
So that's really cool. Did you guys know this?
No, I've seen the picture you showed with the sun rise coming directly through, but I have not seen how accurate this is, no.
Exactly. Now, this work is not mine. It's from Norwegian Tor Lomsdalen. And he wrote a book, Sky and Purpose in Prehistoric Malta. One can buy it on Amazon.com. Maybe $25, $30, something like that. It's a really good book. If I was going to Malta, as I am as well on a different trip, I'd read this book because I'd get a better sense of what's it all about. Because your guide is going to tell you that they mark the equinoxes and the solstices, undoubtedly, okay? But Tori, his work, he actually did the work, the field work. I mean, he did as we see the images right here. Really cool site. Now, Tori received a PhD in archaeology in Malta, okay? And so the archaeologists are on his team, which is cool. And so they see the soil alignments at the Menadra temple, but they say this is not for all the temples, which is true because we don't find this at all the temples because there's inconsistent orientations of these freestanding Malta temples. The orientations of the where the pathway is into the temples. Okay. Because they're all over the board. Okay. Now, back in 1980, people were asking these same questions. They didn't do Tori's, picture work, brilliant work. And they recognized that the axes of these temples are not at random, okay? Because you see these two clusters, which is statistically impossible, okay? But they're still all over the place. We see this circle. They're all over the place. And many of these temple alignments are out of the sun and moon rising and setting ranges. So what's it all about? What's it all about? So enter the Dutch researcher Leni Redijk. And she's got a book too, Cirrus. And you can buy, if you type in Leni Redijk on Google, you will find her webpage and you can buy the book from her. It's not on Amazon at this moment. So Lenny's smart. Leni is like really smart. I'm going to tell you this. In the world of archaeoastronomy, you know, she's at the top. I mean, she's absolutely brilliant, but she's not an archaeoastronomer. And she did the field research. So Leni said, well, what about the stars? Where these characters are looking? We saw the stargazer one before. We have another two women. One is obviously looking up. What about the stars? And she said, well, let's start looking at the stars. She looked at many stars, but she ultimately came down to Cirrus, the bright star in Canis Major. Okay. Now, you've had many people on this program talk about precession, and precession is the Earth wobbles like a top, right? That's how it is. And it's over roughly 26,000 year cycle. And as the Earth is wobbling, the constellations or and stars within them will sort of rise and go below the horizon over hundreds and thousands of years that you'd actually notice it. And there's that's no thing. So what Leni did, she worked with Peter Bartel, an astronomer, and they came up with a curve of the precession. And the blue line is the position of Cirrus on the horizon. And the red line is Cirrus above the horizon. And on this curve, the Cirrus setting is at the top, and Cirrus rising is at the bottom. So this curve is representing that wobbling of the Earth that one would see Cirrus. So it wobbles down and it wobbles up again. Okay, brilliant work. Okay. Now then, what she did was she looked at the temples and how they the entrances to the temples intersected the visible horizon, the azimuths towards Cirrus, okay? And she found connections, okay? Lots and lots of connections, as in mathematically, you only find these things in engineering studies. That's the certainty of her math. It's perfect math. So how does it work? So we're going to take one example, Gigantea North Temple. We can see it intersects at about 5350 BCE. We're on the Cirrus rising. This is helical rising of Cirrus, and of course the setting of Cirrus as well. Meaning it's the first time it's seen, not every day that it is seen. So it's a one off in a sense. Okay, and we can see how it intersects there with Gigantea North Temple, with the entrance. And this isn't rocket science to read this, but you got to have to take it step by step. And she has this in her book, and one can read it. And you could, when you're at these sites, you can take her book, you can take her chart and have a compass, and you can re-see where these were on the horizon. You obviously can't see Cirrus 5000 BCE, but you can see what they would have seen during the daytime. And was there a clear path that you would have seen Cirrus just above, 2 degrees above the horizon? And she investigated all these temples as well. In fact, you can do that. So she says, based on her research, and by the way, I think her work, as I said, she's absolutely brilliant. It's incredible work. And she says that, well, in this case, Cirrus rising would be 5350 BCE, Gigantea at the North Temple, which archaeologists would, you know, that's okay, we're good with that. You know, it's just fine. That's one in our range for these temples. Okay. But then she says Hagar Kim within the canopy today would be 11,000 years ago for Cirrus setting. That's what she's, and that's what that's the man
right
shows
in the Göbekli Tepe time, right?
Oh, that's where, you're getting ahead of me, guys. You're getting ahead of me. Tarshan Temple, 11,000 years ago with Cirrus rising. and Menadra North Temple 10,000 years ago, Sierra setting. And what she says, which is absolutely true, the foundations of these temples were never directly dated. The dating comes from artifacts, you know, animal remains, bones and stuff that they found stuck in the walls that they buried up. They dug up in the area. These stones were never directly dated. She's 100% correct on that. So archaeologically, the dates that I gave you from the start are correct. But if we take it at another dimension, that is the archaeoastronomy, they don't align at all.
And the archaeologists can't account for cohabitation after the fact. You know, 1,000 years later, some people come across and start patching holes in the walls with bones and things like that. And just, I mean, but the same thing we'd do if we had no houses like we do today. If you went someplace and you found a bunch of sort of half-finished temples or mostly together stuff, you would go and live in them.
Exactly. You totally.
And you'd now, be waste there, and then the archaeologists would find that and date that because the other stuff is long gone, and now your stuff is sort of, what's the word, contaminated everything that was there before. I mean, these sites could have been getting contaminated over and over again by half a dozen different cultures over those 3,000 or 4,000 years.
Yeah, there needs to be that structural dating, like the Cyclopean. It's just like the Cyclopean architecture in Peru and everywhere else too. It's just, it's not a structural dating; it's a cultural dating.
Exactly. Now, what? It's possible that the walls of these temples were built 5,000 years ago, but that the foundations are much older. There's multiple levels of megalithic stone foundations that you can't see from this perspective, from this sky view. And then there's stone.
So what do you mean by that when you say foundation? You're talking about like the flooring, like massive.
The flooring. So it's possible that the floor, well, obviously the flooring was made first, right? It was oriented first, obviously. But the flooring could have been made first. And so the archaeological dating of the walls, okay, guys, we're good with that. But the flooring is the orientation to the helical rising and setting of Cirrus. And when you go to these sites, you're gonna walk across, like, you're gonna be on walkways in some of them, and you're gonna look down and you're gonna see the megalithic stones below them.
I was just gonna ask you that. So it has different levels of visible, different levels of stonework, yes, too.
There's visible different level of stonework below the feet, one's feet.
And I'm going to go ahead and assume that the stuff underneath is bigger and better.
It's big. I don't know if it's better. I don't know if it's better. I can't speak to that one. That's not my.
I just mentioned that because that's what we've seen in Egypt, is we'd go to these places that were excavated and you'd see amazing giant megaliths with the seams we're used to seeing. And then on top of that, you'd see some crappier stuff. And then on some of the sites, you'd even see right out to where there's just got the Roman mud bricks on top of that that are total crap compared to whatever was going on before then. So you can see that when the Romans were there, they were already patching this stuff up.
Absolutely. Exactly. So I don't know if it's better down below, but I can tell you, I do this sort of archaeoastronomy for the cave art, and I've done it in your program before. And how I do it is I actually start within the archaeological dates of the pigments on the walls, which are pretty good. And then what I do is I determine the seasonality. So I'll fine tune it from, let's say, 16,000 to 19,000 years to June of 17,010 or something. So I can fine tune it with the seasonality based on the animals and sometimes with the flora. So I do archaeoastronomy as well. She's pushing it out, whereas I fine tune it because I have good archaeological dating on the walls. She doesn't have that. She has, you know, someone threw away a goat bone.
What about that and, red paint? That's a pigment. Can that be dated? Has anyone dated the red paint?
Okay, so the red. Okay, but so that the pigment can, I believe it, that can be, actually the answer is it would, it can be dated if it was made through somebody's DNA. So they chewed up the pigment and spit it on the wall, or that can be dated, but not in itself. It can't be dated. And so in some cave art, you can, yeah, if someone's, if the DNA is still in the pigment, but you don't, from her perspective, that doesn't really matter about the pigment. It's because the foundations of these temples were lined. They, the walls didn't go up first. You guys built, you guys in the building business, you know, who builds a wall first? You, you build the ground first. So she's saying it's the foundation and that they are in fact aligned. So how does that then work with Göbekli Tepe, right? Okay. It's in the window, isn't it? It's in the window. Okay. And, you know, it's, she was not, her aim in this was not to put it in the window of Göbekli Tepe.
Exactly.
Her aim was to look at it, it from an archaeoastronomy perspective.
Göbekli Tepe would have been undiscovered when she did this, right? We didn't even know about it.
Well, actually, when she did this, Göbekli Tepe had been discovered. But when she first arrived at Malta and she was started as a tour guide, I think that was like 30 years ago, and started asking these questions, Göbekli Tepe had not been discovered. So going back to her early days, and there were people before her time that she, after she did her statistical research, she found that in fact there was someone back in the 1940s or so that had the same hypothesis. And so she says, you know, this isn't my fascination, it's something along like that. I don't know exact words, but I didn't make other people have thought this. This is not me being crazy. She didn't say that either, but along those lines. But yeah, we're in the window there, aren't we? So what do the archaeologists think? Well, there's no archaeological evidence to support this hypothesis. And they're correct. The archaeologists are 100% correct that there's no evidence from their perspective to support the hypothesis. And as we talked earlier, the Maltese came out of Sicily 7,000 years ago, unquestionably. But the Maltese came from someplace else, right? And there are no megalithic structures as we find at Malta, or these upright metal structures, we don't find them on Sicily. So they didn't make them and design them in Sicily and then carry them, the concepts over to Malta. And so that's why they say, that the archaeologists say, that the Maltese developed the complexes on their own. So that is, that becomes, that's their story. But again, these are the same people, the archaeologists, and I'm not doubting archaeologists, right? I'm not doing that. They're the same people that said that they had the oldest freestanding structure in the world until the discovery of Göbekli Tepe. These are the same people. Okay, same people.
And they might be partly right, because it might be the repurposed culture had their own thing, their own growing culture and their own, you know, like their own development. The people that repurposed it might have had their own style and their own sort of development. Yes. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't, like, the foundations weren't part of a larger global architecture at some point.
Yes. Knowledge that came from someplace else, undeniably. And these people did not learn how to cook and kill game on Malta. They brought that from someplace else. So could they have brought it from Anatolia, ancient Turkey, prehistoric Turkey? I have no issue with that. Okay. And the foundations of these temples have not been dated. That is the truth. So can one, has one resolve this? Well, you got to pull up some of the stone and see what's down there. Bottom line, can you find any datable artifacts down there? But the stones themselves cannot, the stones can't be dated, but it's possible there's artifacts below them. And people say you can't question science. That's what they say. You can't question scientists, all that sort of stuff. Well, the scientific process is continuing, and questioning is part of the process. So Lenny came in with solid data, solid statistics, mathematically brilliant, and she partnered with someone else to help her do that. So she is questioning observations that she made that came after somebody else's conclusions. Okay. That is what science is about. And it's okay the people who say you can't question scientists or can't question scientists, science is totally bogus because that is the scientific process. But you will hear that from people out there. It's a process. It's not a final certainty. So in a summary of this whole thing from Bernie's perspective, right? This is my show. And Plato borrowed elements of Atlantis from earlier writers, Sanchinatho and Herodotus for sure, possibly others. Okay. There's pre-Greek archaeological ruins at Malta that Plato knew about or his friends knew about, and they would have thought they were from a lost civilization. They had no way of dating them. Absolutely no way. And the dating question, Malta ruins, have not been entirely illuminated by researchers. And it's possible that Lenny is half right. It could be even older. I'm not saying it is older, but there's more research that needs to be done in this question of the dating. So it's not been entirely illuminated, because science is a process. It is a circle. And we keep questioning him. We question the conclusions, and then we learn from them, from what we can look from other perspectives. That's what science is, okay? Plato definitely used elements from his Malta to construct his mythical Atlantis empire. So Malta wasn't Atlantis or Ground Zero. It was Jebel Tobelka in the Atlas Mountains of present-day southwestern Morocco. That's what Sanchinatho and Herodotus give us. But clearly the empire itself would have extended into the islands of Malta. And Plato's dating of Atlantis cannot be tied to Malta, because he basically threw out these big wild even numbers, right? 9,000, 10,000 years. Because there were metaphors to him. He had no way of dating these things from the past. People say procession, all this stuff, but he didn't know that. And people at his time, there's nothing that they could have done to figure out these dates on Malta. Even if they had concept of procession of the equinoxes, they still could not have done the work that Lenny did. Totally impossible. With their knowledge of precession of the equinoxes. Does it work out? It's kind of cool that it does work out. But Plato didn't know that. And so I'd say it's coincidental, but it's like a pretty amazing and really cool coincidence. That's my perspective. But others will say say different things. And I'm okay with that, because science is a continuing process. We're here to question, and we are here to learn. But bottom line, and why people are going to your tour in Malta, and why they're going to go someday, they've been to your Easter Island tour, and why they will someday go to your Göbekli tour, is that we are captivated by mysteries. It's part of who we are. We can't escape from our own imaginations. And some of our imagination ideas can be proven. In the case of Lenny, in the case of Tor, who did their archaeoastronomy work. Brilliant work for both of them. But some things are still, they're mysteries. And that's what wakes us up in the morning. Special for you guys, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So here's a question. Before we should I get out of this screen so I can see the whites in your eyes? Or do you want to go back and look at the slides? Go back.
Well, I have a question about how the hypogeum fits into all this, because that seems to me like it would be the obvious thing that people in the past, like the Greeks and stuff, would have been like, whoa, where did this come from? And what kind of lost civilization made this thing?
Yeah, so the hypogeum is, I haven't fully worked it out in my head. And a few reasons for that is, one is that the hypogeum was found in recent years, maybe it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago or so. I'm not exactly sure. It was buried. So I'm still trying to sort out my head. And in this presentation, I focused on the standing structures, okay, that we can date through Lenny's work. We can also date the foundations through Lenin. We can certainly date the walls through archaeologists, always when people use them. And that's kind of how I approach this. But the hypogeum is really a different animal. It's a different structure, being in that it is below ground. And there's questions that remain to be answered about how the hypogeum is right next, you know, 300 yards from the Tarshan temples, which you guys are going to go to. And were they connected underground? Is there more underground? I assume there's a lot more underground, because the hypogeum was found by accident. Nobody was looking for it. And it's so close to the Tarshan temples. My bet is there's a lot more going on below ground. And over time, when people are digging wells or fixing the pipes or whatever they're doing, there's going to be more of those that come up that will better explain the hypogeum story. I think that one temple is only part of a larger story that we haven't found yet. That's just my perspective. Is that fair, guys?
It's interesting that it was buried, though, because you got that buried. You got Göbekli Tepe and all those other, the other two tepes buried, Karan Tepe and the other one. And then you also have the giant underground cities in Turkey.
Yeah,
it can't be a coincidence. I mean, it can be, but it's a crazy one.
Yeah, so I'm with you guys. I think that, you know, when they first dug up Göbekli Tepe or they unearthed Göbekli Tepe, they realized that these T-pillars all over the area are sticking up from the ground. But they didn't know what they were until they excavated Göbekli Tepe. And now that we have, not we, but archaeologists have excavated the hypogeum, there's got to be more of those down there.
Did you see the thing from, I think it was Trevor Grassi recently, about the Egypt, the Giza Plateau, thousands of shafts going down into the underground. And Darren and I have always talked about how all the pyramid, the Bent Pyramid, the Red Pyramid, and the Giza Plateau, and even to Saqqara, maybe all might be connected underground. Like that whole thing might be like an underground city under there. And now he's saying there's like thousands of shafts going down. So that's pretty crazy.
There's a lot we don't know. There's a lot to be explored and many mysteries. And when you guys go out with your group to Malta, bring compasses and, you know, bring Lenny's book as well as Tor's book, and take your compasses and stand at those temples, the Menadra North or whatever, and look to see what she was seeing. You won't see, obviously you won't see the Sirius because it was a long, long time ago. It won't be, and you're not going to get up that early, and you probably won't be there at the Harlacra rising date anyway. But you can see the perspective that these people have, and that's part of the magic. It's you will have the most incredible contact at the cabin ever if you guys bring compasses and their books.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Is there anything else about the solar and lunar cycles around those? Like, you know how you showed the one where the sunrise was coming through and then you could see the edge of the pillar? Like, was there anything?
So that's what your guide's going to say. Okay. So there are places where the solstices and equinoxes, the sun peaks through the stones. It's real. Okay. The question is, was it designed that way? Whereas what I showed with Tor's work at Menadra, we've got 3 points of contacts at the equinoxes and the solstices. You can't make that one up. It's not random. It's just totally impossible. Whereas these other ones, you know, they're going to point in the floor and say that's where the light comes through at the winter solstice. And yes, it does. But that's not the level of research that Tor did.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a completely different level. It's, you know, the winter solstice peaks through the over the house down the road.
I was just wondering if the alignments would signify the age of them at all, too, like, because there's been a lot of work done now on the alignments of these ancient sites towards like old North, the old Magnetic North, for example, or
I don't know that. Yeah, that's not my
yeah.
That's no. That's
it's above your pay grade.
That's above my pay grade. That's what people do up in Calgary. It's where the brilliant types do. Yeah, that's above me. But yeah, it's you guys are gonna have an amazing trip. I'll be there in December with Helen, and we're gonna be with a bunch of people. But we're not doing we're not doing the whole contact in the cabin drinking beer. And I hear the malted beer is very good, but it also tastes doesn't taste like beer. It's got something else thrown into it. But yeah,
maybe some magical.
You guys are gonna have ton of fun, and I recommend go buy those two books. You can share them between you and bring compasses. When you go through, my recommendation also that you pack your compasses and you check on bag, because if you bring a compass through the through the carry-on bags, it's gonna get tagged, and they're gonna say, well, what are you doing with the compass in the airplane? And I've been there many, many times. So my suggestion is put in your check-on bag. and then I have to explain that I do archaeoastronomy, and they say, well, what's that? Guys, I'll buy another one when I get there if I have to.
Absolutely. Yeah. That might be a good idea. Bring some compasses for that one. That would be the gift we give out to people so they can check out all these different alignments.
Oh, yeah. You can get, $10 compasses, plastic ones, then put it on a map and do it. I'd also recommend, you saw all these images that I had of the temples themselves and the layouts. I would go to Wikipedia or someplace and print them off, because your guide's probably won't have all those. And so people can put the compass on the temple maps, and then you line it up and see how you are. Otherwise, you just got a compass. You need to see the map to orient yourself to what people would have seen 11,000 years ago. You guys gonna kill it. Yeah. But now you have tools, right?
Yeah, I appreciate the Atlantis take on it, because we're always poking around for Atlantis around here. And it is interesting that would have been in Plato's version of the world, that would have been the only ruins they had that they didn't have a story for. The Egyptians were still there. They said all that stuff was their ancestors, but they didn't know where this stuff came from.
They didn't know where it came from. And they knew about it. It's obvious, right? Crete, they also could have thought, was Atlantis. Crete has the same iconography. Crete's a cool place. But this is, on the scale of things, remember, in today's world, it's Göbekli Tepe here, it's Malta here, and then it's, Crete, Rome, and all these other places down here. Malta is number two. People in the United States may not realize, I'm sure people in Canada know all this stuff. But Europeans go there on vacation. They know about this stuff, but not Americans. It's number two, guys, number two in the world. And possibly equal to number one, according to Lenny.
It was interesting because the Eastern Islanders, Easter Islanders, think that they've got a connection to Turkey as well.
Interesting.
To Göbekli Tepe, because of some snake, some serpents that look the same.
The temples at Malta have the snakes too, carved in relief into the limestone.
Yeah, which lines up with a couple places then.
Yeah. It makes it interesting how we are obviously all connected, right? The question is, how far back in time are we connected? And then what did we borrow from each other? People didn't invent how to cook at different times around the world. It was older and they carried it with them in the same way that they made stone objects, and I would say megaliths. I don't believe these people in Malta invented megaliths on their own. undoubtedly, they had nuances to their megaliths. People at Stonehenge didn't invent them on their own. This tradition carried around the Western Mediterranean. I mean, this isn't rocket science. But of course, people in the UK might not see it that way, because they have the most magnificent megalosite site in the UK, right? And that part of Europe. But yeah,
fascinating stuff.
You guys gonna send me pictures? You know,
absolutely. There's also
Some beach pictures, maybe some boat action, you know, water skiing, that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. And you're going before us, so maybe you can send us what you find when you're over there and you get your boots on the ground here in December.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's going to be fun stuff.
And I'm
looking forward to doing a presentation before your Göbekli Tepe contact in the cabin.
It's coming, guys. It's coming sooner than later. Of course, people can check out contact@thecabin.com. There is still about a dozen spots left for that Malta trip. If people want to jump in it, now's the time. You can get your deposit in and get on a monthly payment plan to clear up the rest for our first-class Malta trip, three islands, Sicily, Sardinia, and Malta. Bernie Taylor, this has been fantastic. Thank you for spending some time in Grimerica. Again, where can people find all your stuff? We'll put links to the past episodes in the show notes. We have some cave stuff, some Antarctica stuff, a bunch of stuff in the back that we've done with Bernie before. That's all fantastic.
Well, after people subscribe to Grimerica, and then after they push the notification button, go to my webpage, beforeorion.com, links to all the places I've been, or many of the places I've been, beforeorion.com. You type in, you Google Bernie Taylor, I'm out there.
Bunch of Bernie Taylor, six times in Grimerica. Bernie Taylor, thank you very much. Your upload's at 100% already, so your internet is good. You're good to go. Thank you, Bernie. Come back anytime.
Thanks, buddy. That was awesome.
Fun session.
And that was a chat with the one and only Bernie Taylor. I encourage people to check out the back catalog. We've had a bunch of fantastic tumbles down the rabbit hole with Bernie, and this Malta one is no exception. Big thanks to Bernie for coming on the show. Check out beforeorion.com. Also check out GrimericaOutlaw.ca for the podcast. Contact@thecabin.com for those trips and events. AdultBrain.ca for the audiobook. SimulationMaps.com. DisasterMaps.ca. And of course, the new smartest book club on the internet, school, that's SKOOL.com/audiobooks, will bring you to the Grimoire, where we're almost at 200 members already. So jump into that, where we're shooting out the biggest and best and smartest book club on the internet. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
Five pink flamingos and a few flamenco dancers. They're in the kitchen and they're baking Day of the Dead cookies. And I step into the kitchen and I'm like, let me have a looky, see what kind of cookie you're cooking up. And they're looking up at me skeptical, and I point next to my spectacles. And I'm wearing a maroon Harvard t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a smart cookie, but I'm no psychic. You can come and ring my bell. But where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. Me and five of my best friends, few of my enemies. We're at the coffee shop and we're settling our differences. Benjamin Otto pulls out a game of Chinese checkers and he orders a cappuccino. And I pick blue and he picks red and you pick yellow. And I'm wearing a tie-dye peace sign t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a peacenik, but I ain't no hypocrite. You can come and ring my bell. But where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. man. And with my sense of smell, I can smell the salt in your tears. And I can sense your fears. You're hoping for a bit of divinity in this worldly vicinity. And you understand the fragility of the human vessel. And you sit Indian style like a pretzel. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state.